Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hi, welcome back to the show. I am your overnight dude here on Chicago's very own 720 WGN. And we're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here until 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell coming up, and then the great Steve Cochran at 6. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. Also, send your texts to 312-981-7200. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. But the best way to stay connected is to like us on Facebook. We're approaching 12,000 fans on our Facebook page. So let's hit that plateau right now by liking us. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, my guest right now is a guy who's been on the show many times. He's a regularist on the show, and he is a really terrific writer and a very funny guy and an interesting guy. And he chooses really quirky, interesting, and very, very cool things to write about. He is a writer for Priceonomics blog, and he has a website called Zachariah Crockett with two T's, .com. And his name is Zach Crockett, and we're going to talk about his some of the recent articles that he's written for Priceonomics. And let's welcome Zach back to the show. Zach, how you doing, man?
Hey, Nick. Good to be back, man. Oh,
thanks. All right. Give everybody a little background on you and a little bit about Priceonomics. And I understand that you will soon be making a move
Yeah,
so that's going to be a big one. But give everybody your background and what you write about in Priceonomics and stuff.
Yeah, sure. I'm a writer out here in San Francisco. Priceonomics is kind of like this small little economics blog that I've been a part of for 2 years. And a lot of what I do is I take kind of seemingly boring topics and try to make them interesting. So I'll write about something like some kind of mundane invention that you never really think about that might have an interesting backstory, like scotch tape or the shopping cart or something.
Right.
So that's a lot of what we do here, is try to take the more mundane stories in life and try to make them interesting.
Well, you know, that we do a lot of that here on the show. We like to talk about kind of unusual things and things that might bring back memories or things that you've wondered about that you
right.
live with all the time. And that's a lot of what we do, and one of the reasons why we like you so much on the show.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's you're always so flattering about my work, so I appreciate it.
So you started writing for Priceonomics a couple of years ago. Were you a writer before that for anything else?
Yeah, you know, not really professionally, but I've always been a writer. I grew up in a household of, you know, English teachers, and you know, my parents read me Shakespeare in the bathtub. So as far back as I go, I've always thought of myself as a writer.
Very cool.
And yeah, it's been fun.
Now we want to talk about some of the stuff that you've written about. Now, you did mention the shopping cart. I definitely want to get into that. It's a pretty fascinating and interesting story, and but you are going to be making a move, and actually literally moving to a different city, not only to a different place for you to write, but also to a different city. Tell me about what's going on there. You're going to go to Vox.com, V-O-X?
Yeah, so in about 2 weeks, I'm moving from San Francisco out to Washington, D.C. to work at this website called Vox. It's kind of like an offshoot of the Washington Post that was started in 2014. So I'm going to be doing that, you know, more or less the same kind of storytelling, like, you know, culture, maybe like a slightly more political twist to my stories. But, yeah, I'm excited, man. It's I've always kind of been a California kid, so it's going to be weird living on the East Coast. But D.C. is quite a city, so.
It is. I mean, I'm sure you'll have a great time, but it's going to be quite an adjustment for you, man. I mean, you're going all the way across the country.
Yeah, my girlfriend's not a big fan of that. I was supposed to move in with her in a few months, and now I'm pretty much doing the opposite. So.
Oh, well, why don't you? She doesn't want to move to D.C. with you?
No, she's in school out here, so she's going to be stuck in San Francisco for a while.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, but it's a good move for you. You're looking forward to it. You're going to be working for Vox.com. So the next time we have you on in a few weeks, we'll get you back on, and you can tell us all about what it's like to be in D.C., how you've adjusted. Have you gone out?
And
you've gone out. You visited. You got your place and everything already?
Oh, I'm still working out the kinks. I actually don't have a place yet, so I'm flying out in 2 weeks. I don't know where the heck I'm going, but it should be an adventure.
Well, you know, I went to D.C. I went to D.C. one time, and it was on a baseball trip. My friends and I got into a van, and we drove across the east part of the country and stopped in Cleveland to see a game. We went to New York. We went to Yankee Stadium. We went to the Hall of Fame. We went to Baltimore. And so on our way to Baltimore, we stopped off at D.C.,
Oh, man, great trip.
Oh, it's awesome, but here's the ridiculous thing. This is how much of an idiot I am, Zach. there's a lot of important, incredible, historical things to see in Washington, D.C., obviously. But the very first place that I insisted that we stopped was at the Exorcist Steps in Georgetown.
I'm not surprised, man. You're a movie guy. So.
Yeah. I was just like, we got to go to the Exorcist Steps right now. And it was, you know, and then we went to the Smithsonian and the Capitol and all that stuff, and that was all that was peanuts compared to the Exorcist Steps. So
yeah, for sure.
Make sure you check that out when you get to Georgetown, Zach.
Oh, that might be one of my first stops too.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on the move. I'm sorry that your girlfriend won't be able to move with you, but it's gonna be good for your career. So Priceonomics, we can read this. Let's talk about this, man. How a basket on wheels revolutionized grocery shopping. This is a terrific story, man, and this is what you do so well. We look at a grocery cart. Nobody ever really thinks about the origin of it and how things were when you never had a grocery cart. Tell us about this.
Yeah, you know, you see these things pretty much every time you go shopping, and it's just about the most boring thing you can imagine. We push these things around, and it's just like a boring metal cart. But when you really get into it, it's like the grocery cart really revolutionized the way we shop in a lot of ways. And it's contributed a lot to shifting consumerism in America. So I wanted to dig into the history a little bit and take a look. You know, there are, like, on any given day, 25 million people are using a shopping cart in the United States.
Yeah.
So going back, it was actually invented by this guy in this Oklahoman, I don't know if that's the correct term to call people Oklahoma, but
I think so.
So this guy was kind of born and bred at the turn of the 20th century. His father was a grocer. He grew up in around grocery stores and shopping. And back then, grocery stores were really different. So basically, you'd walk into a store, and some guy in a white apron would tend to your every need. You know, most things would be behind a counter, so you'd select what you want, and this guy would go grab this stuff for you and give it to you over the counter. But around the 1930s, this big shift started to happen. Like, people started thinking about maybe having a self-serve store. So you'd go in, you'd have this tiny little wicker basket, and you'd go around, and there'd be all these shelves, and you'd pick off your items off the shelves. So this guy, Sylvan Goldman, this guy from Oklahoma, he started catching on to this around the mid-1930s, and he you know, went on some adventures. He went to Texas, started a grocery store, went out to California, learned a little bit of the trade, and then came back to Oklahoma and started this really wildly successful chain. It was, like, expanded to 55 stores within a year. But he started noticing he had a problem. His customers would come in, they'd have these tiny little baskets, and they could only carry so much in the basket. And he realized, like, his sales were starting to stagnate, so he had to find a solution.
And so he was inspired he started, actually, wasn't it, like, he would have people really attentive people who worked in the store, like, when he noticed that the employees would notice that their grocery baskets would get full, they would give him another one.
Yeah, so he started, you know, coming up with all these wacky solutions to trying to get people to buy more groceries.
Right.
One of them would be what you mentioned. You know, if someone filled their cart, they'd drop it off at the cash register, and then they'd get a new one. But that wasn't really that successful. People didn't really like that idea. It didn't really catch on. Another idea he had was to, and this is literally one of his ideas, was to build a mini little train that carried these carts around the aisles, and you could just knock down whatever items you wanted into your cart. Obviously, that didn't go over well.
That's such a crazy
overhead there.
I really wish that, you know, I got to tell you something, Zach. I really wish that would have taken off. I swear, that just sounds like it would be so much fun to grocery shop.
Yeah, you know, maybe it's not too late. Maybe there's a demand for that. So.
Yeah, yeah.
but anyway, so finally in 1936, he was sitting in his office late one night. He was fed up. He didn't really know what to do. His businesses were crumbling a little bit because his sales were stagnating. And he looked at this folding chair, of all things. He looked at a folding chair, and he had this genius idea to basically take this folding chair, put some wheels on it, some casters from an old, like, you know, wheel cart or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he attached one of the wicker baskets to the top of the folding chair. So you have this kind of like rudimentary cart that you could wheel around the store. And then also, since it was a folding chair, he was able to double up the cart. So he put one on top of the seat and one below the seat. Mm. So it's kind of this two-tiered cart system, and it basically doubled the amount of items that people could buy. So he was really excited about this invention. He took it into his stores, put it on display in the front of the store, and people were coming in, and they didn't want to have anything to do with it. Basically, it was a huge failure. Like, the woman hated it because they had been pushing around baby carts all day, and they didn't want to push around another cart.
Right.
And the men said, you know, with my big burly arms, I can carry my own groceries. I don't need some you know, pansy little cart to carry around
right.
my stuff.
Right.
So it was kind of a big fail at first. So Goldman, he was kind of this master marketeer, and he tried all these things. He hired an attractive girl to stand with the carts. He took out all these weird newspaper ads trying to convince people that it was this great new invention. And nothing really worked. So finally, as a last resort, he actually hired actors to push his own carts around his stores. And he'd have them say things like, "Ooh, this cart is so nice. It's changing my life." And, you know, slowly but surely, the herd mentality took effect, and all of his customers in the store started to realize that maybe these carts were something special.
Yeah.
And within 3 or 4 years, these things really, really took off. They were all over Oklahoma, then they expanded all through the South, and obviously, you know, within 20, 30 years, they were all over the United States, and they kind of changed the way we shop.
Yeah, but there's an interesting side note to the story is that there's this guy in 1946 named Orla E. Watson, and
sure.
he designed what is now commonly the you know, one of the most ingenious parts of the shopping cart, that rear swinging door so that the shopping carts can be stacked into one another.
Yeah, a big problem that Goldman had when he invented the shopping cart was these things were kind of massive and they took up a lot of room in his store. So this guy, Orla Watson, he invented what was called the telescopic cart. You know, you could stack them together.
Yeah.
And this is really what we know today as the shopping cart. But the thing is, Orla Watson never gets credit for his idea because Goldman kind of screwed him over a little bit. He heard about Watson's idea and negotiated some contracts and basically screwed Watson out of his invention.
Yeah, it's that cutthroat world of shopping cart inventions.
That's right.
But that's it's a fascinating story, man. It really is. And now,
yeah.
You know, when I see a shopping cart, I'm going to think about this, and I'm actually going to think about poor Mr. Watson. I got to tell you, you know, I mean, that's like one of the most ingenious parts of the shopping cart. It really is. This guy
yep.
invented it. It's amazing. Okay, we're going to take a break. Zach, hang on, okay, man?
Yep.
And you also talk about another invention in one of these pieces that you can see at Priceonomics.com. And I got to tell you, when I found out that you wrote about the Wawa pedal, I kind of went nuts. I got to tell you. All right,
yeah.
So hang on a second, all right, Zach?
Sure.
Okay, cool. Zach Crockett is with us. He currently writes for a Priceonomics blog, but he's going to be joining the staff of VOX, Vox.com, in a couple of weeks. But he will continue to write about really interesting and really fun stuff. Always enjoy having Zach on. We'll come back more. We'll come back to more of this on 720 WGN. Oh, yeah. Good morning, everybody. Hi. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And my guest is Zach Crockett. He's a writer for Priceonomics blog. And you can also, we'll soon be able to read him at Vox.com. He's a regular on the show, and he writes really interesting offbeat articles about things that you never really think about, and then you read these fascinating stories behind them. And they're always very entertaining, informative, and fun. And Zach Crockett, we welcome you back to the show. Welcome back, Zach.
Hey, man.
All right. We got to talk about the invention of the Wawa pedal, which I think is one of my favorite musical inventions of all time. And effects for musicians. Tell everybody what the Wawa pedal is, if we can best describe it.
Yeah, it's basically, so, you know, when you think of the Wawa pedal, you basically think of like Voodoo Child of Jimi Hendrix. It's kind of like, it's this pedal that as a guitar player, you flip up and down with your foot. And as you do so, it kind of sounds like a baby crying. It creates this really squealy, like, tonal noise to the guitar that really, creates a very strange dynamic. And, I'm a musician, and I've always used this thing, and I've always wondered where it came from. And I think anyone who remotely knows about rock music or listens to it at least recognizes the sound of this thing. It's so right. iconic today.
Right. And it is also, for people who might not know it right away, and you get into this in the article about how it became like a very, very important part of 70s and 80s funk.
Absolutely.
And disco. But also porno music. Immediately when people think of like porno music, they go wow, chicka, wow, wow, stuff like that. And that's someone imitating a wah pedal.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's really ubiquitous in every single genre. I mean, from pornos to Jimi Hendrix to the Shaft soundtrack, it's just everywhere.
Yeah. Well, and now you talk about the invention of the wah-wah pedal, let's go back to the beginning. Of course, it ties into the Beatles, as everything does. Everything does, yes.
Yeah. So in a weird roundabout way, it kind of starts with the Beatles, not directly, but. So basically in 1964, the Beatles were preparing for their first world tour. They were, gaining a lot of steam as an act. And at the time, they were playing these amplifiers called Vox. That was the brand name of the amplifiers. And Vox, the Beatles crowds were getting huge, like 10,000 plus people. And basically, they needed to create a larger amp for the Beatles to play with. So they started experimenting, and eventually they partnered up with this company in the United States called the Thomas Organ Company. And it was kind of there in the dungeons of the Thomas Organ Company in Los Angeles that this really weird pedal came about. So in 1965, there was this team of Thomas Organ engineers, and they started working on these new Vox amplifiers that were supposed to be louder for these rock bands. And this one young engineer named Thomas Plunkett, he was tasked with taking apart one of these amps and trying to make it cheaper while still retaining the sound quality. And one little part he found was this little switch called the mid-range boost on the amplifier. So you switch this thing on, and it would boost all the middle frequencies of the guitar. Basically, we'd create this like really sweet tone. And he found that you could replace it with this thing called a potentiometer. So it basically achieved the exact same effect, but it was like pennies on the dollar cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was in the workshop rotating this potentiometer, which basically, it's like a resistor that it's basically like a fancy resistor. And he basically found he was rotating this thing while his friend was playing the guitar, and he noticed it made this ridiculous, like, wah, wah, wah sound. And he took a pedal from an organ, snapped this thing into the pedal, and rigged it so that you could move it with your foot while you're playing guitar. And that was really the origin of the pedal.
And because obviously you couldn't play the guitar and manipulate this thing at the same time. So, but he took a pedal. He actually took a pedal off of an organ.
Right. Yeah. He took this old organ pedal, snapped this thing in there. His friend who was helping him play this thing could easily just toggle the pedal up and down. Now, what happens really inside the pedal? What happens is you're rotating the potentiometer, so it's changing the resistance. So when the pedal is pushed down, the notes are a really low frequency. They're like really bassy and flat. And when the pedal is pushed up, it's really high trebly frequencies. And when you rotate it really quickly and shift between those frequencies, you create this really unique sound, like a baby crying.
And it kind of revolutionized. I mean, people got a hold of it, and they really loved it. And it was really sort of like Frank Zappa, who was one of the first guys to really say, this is something I want to use.
Yeah, of all people, of course it would be Zappa. But, there was this kind of studio musician named Del Kasher, who was involved with Vox amplifiers. And as the story goes, Kasher started playing it with his prototype, and then he showed it to Zappa, And then Zappa showed it to Clapton, and Clapton showed it to Hendrix. that's how the story goes. And basically, you know, the first really mainstream popularization of this pedal was Cream, of course, like the Tale of the Brave Ulysses. And then a few years later, Hendrix on Axis Bold as Love, he had Voodoo Child, he did Up from the Skies, Voodoo Child. And after Hendrix and Clapton started using it, it just exploded in popularity. Like, pretty much every session player in the rock world is using this thing.
Right. And then you had there were two basic pedals out there. There was the Vox Wah-Wah and then the Crybaby, which became – the Crybaby is the one that is probably the most popular or was at that time, correct?
Yeah. I mean, that was – that when you listen back to all these old records, you're hearing the Crybaby. That was kind of – It was marketed better. It was, it just had more bells and whistles on it. It was the player's favorite.
And not unlike the story that we just told about the shopping cart, there's another sort of ripoff thing here that happened, which I guess happens. I guess historically, almost every invention, something like this happens. Correct. Tell us about this little wrinkle in the story.
Yeah, there's a little wrinkle for Thomas Orton Company. This thing started exploding in popularity. They thought they'd struck a gold mine, right? They could sell millions of these things to guitar players. But they actually forgot to patent it, and what happened was a bunch of people throughout Europe started making knockoffs of this thing.
Yeah.
So they didn't really reap too many rewards from their invention. A ton of knockoffs came out, specifically in Italy, and they're actually really valuable today if you can track them down, these knockoffs. But at the time, there was a lot of like market dilution, and Thomas Orton Company didn't really capitalize on their invention as much as they should have.
You know, in the early 80s, you talk about how the Wah-Wah pedal took a back seat to all the electronic music that was happening and the digital effects and things like that. But then it made a resurgence in popularity the late 80s, early 90s with, you know, Nirvana and all those other bands.
Yeah, exactly.
And to this day, it's still incredibly popular. I love this, that you talk about it, something in 2008 that happened with Jimi Hendrix's old Wah-Wah pedal. Tell everybody this little nugget of information about an old Jimi Hendrix pedal.
Yes, it's seriously incredible how much these things go. In 2008, one of Hendrix's old Wah pedals surfaced at auction, and it basically sold for $15,500.
That's amazing. does it work? Does the pedal work?
Oh, absolutely. The owner who bought it, actually, it was probably a good move, because as soon as he bought it, a ton of bands reached out to this guy, all these modern acts, and they wanted to use the pedal. All these musicians who'd grown up worshipping Jimi Hendrix wanted to lease this pedal out.
Yeah.
So he actually spawned a business renting this thing out to all these popular acts. And, people would rent it out for a couple hundred dollars an hour in studios.
That's amazing. So the Wah-Wah pedal is as popular as ever, and it's a great story, really interesting story. We got to take a break here, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more here, Zach. But when you're researching this stuff, like, where did you go to find out the Wah-Wah pedal? Obviously online and things like that. But when you're researching this stuff, I bet that's half the fun.
Oh yeah, man. So I like to go straight to the sources. I talk to musicians. I talk to companies like Dunlop, obviously, representatives from the company. You got to go straight to the source. You can't really trust anything that's out there on the internet.
Yeah. So. Well, we're going to talk about that after the break, Zach, because you wrote a piece about the most prolific editor on Wikipedia thinking about speaking of don't trust things on the internet. Hang on a second, Zach, all right?
All right, man. Sorry.
All right. Zach Crockett is with us. He writes for Priceonomics Blog, the Priceonomics Blog, and he'll soon be joining the staff of Vox.com. We got more to talk about, including a great story he wrote about Wikipedia, which is coming up next. We'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN. One of the best examples of the Wah-Wah pedal. Yeah, theme from Shaft. Morning, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Our buddy Zach Crockett is a writer for the Priceonomics blog, and he writes about some really offbeat, interesting, and fun stuff. And he wrote about the Wawa pedal, which we just discussed. And that, Zach, I mean, that's the sort of the quintessential Wawa example.
Oh, man, Shaft, man. It never gets old.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, you know, we were talking before the break about how you do research, and you know, you do a lot of research. You try to go to the source material and don't trust everything that you see on the internet. And one of the things that people go to all the time is Wikipedia. But how many people know that anybody can write anything on a Wikipedia page? Are a lot of people aware of that?
It's hard to say. I mean, in the writing community, it's pretty well known. I mean, I think most people know it's kind of an open source thing. Anyone can go in there and write anything, and also anyone can go in there and edit anything. So all the moderators and all of the editors that maintain this website are all volunteers who are doing this for free, and they're all just you know, people like you and I who just do it out of their own volition in their spare time.
Yeah. Now, the opening paragraph of this piece that you wrote, the most prolific editor on Wikipedia, the opening paragraph is pretty staggering. Do you have it with you, or should I read
it?
Do it.
Yeah, on Wikipedia, you know, I think I just checked this afternoon, and I think there are over 5 million articles now on Wikipedia. and if you were to print these and bound them into books, each of them 25 centimeters tall by 5 centimeters thick, like the typical Britannica encyclopedia.
Right.
There'd be 2,207 volumes. And each one of those volumes would contain 1.6 million words.
That's absolutely incredible.
It's kind of hard to picture it, but it's, you know, it's a ton of books. It's just unreal.
Yeah. And as you said, people go in, they start their own Wikipedia page based on a subject. They go in and edit them. They change them. They add stuff to them. I must say, I don't know who started my Wikipedia page, Zach. but at one point it claimed that I had 12 kids, and I don't have any, that I was born in 1865. And just somebody went in there, you know, like one of my goofball listeners went in there and just completely changed it. And there it is for anybody to see. You know, somebody might go to Wikipedia without knowing and think that I have 12 kids.
What I really want to know is, did you really grow up 5 blocks away from Wrigley Field?
I did. That's real. I see you've seen my Wikipedia page. that's actually a fact. That's true.
Sweet. All right.
All right. So let's.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, anyone can just go into your page and write anything they want. You know,
yeah.
I've done it myself. Back in college, I liked to screw around, and I used to go into like George W. Bush's Wikipedia page, and I used to file him under like sexually transmitted diseases or something. Like I'd file his name under a different category. So it's, you know, there are a lot of you know, immature people like me. You know, sleuthing around inside Wikipedia, screwing everything up for everyone.
Right. So tell us about Justin Anthony Knapp.
Yeah. So I wanted to, you know, track down the most prolific editor. Of all these volunteers, who's the guy that has really done the most work? And it's this guy named Justin Anthony Knapp. So I tracked him down. This guy has... He's made 1.5 million edits on Wikipedia.
Oh,
and if you work that out, that's 385 edits a day. he's edited pages ranging from Taylor Swift to the history of blacksmithing. So this guy is quite a prolific. He makes the rounds on Wikipedia. So basically, you know, he's just some normal guy. He went to the University of Indiana. He started reading the site in 2003 and decided he wanted to make a difference. So he, most of his edits are kind of like smaller grammatical things, like adding commas, things like that.
Yeah.
But he'll also occasionally do much larger edits, like he'll rewrite entire pages. He wrote the entire page for George Orwell, the author, and Kurt Vonnegut, and the Smithsonian Museum. He's put in a lot of like pretty amazing work.
And is he?
But I was talking to this guy.
Yeah.
And he was telling me, like, you know, at his peak, at his prime, he was editing 16 hours a day, sometimes making as many as 1,000 edits a day.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And what was his motivation to do this, Zach?
You know, that's what I'm curious about. Why would you devote your time? Because obviously he's not being paid for this.
Right.
You know? Why would you devote 16 hours a day to this seemingly mundane thing? So he really told me, like, he just believes that everyone should do work that's not for money. You should have work in your life that you're doing out of a duty that you feel you have. He was telling me, you know, he feels very privileged. He has studied, like, Western Sahara in Africa a lot, and he feels like he has all the resources he needs. He has an internet connection. He has food and water. So why shouldn't he contribute a positive difference to the world? And I think this is just his way of doing that.
Yeah. And does he how does he do this? Does he just go onto Wikipedia and just scan, you know, random entries and just look for mistakes?
Yeah, there's kind of like a giant listserv of all these errors that need to be corrected. And, you know, anyone can go in and register as an editor, and then you can get access to, like, this kind of stream of real-time edits that need immediate attention. Mm-hmm. They're earmarked for correction. So he kind of just slowly makes his way through these lists. A lot of times he might hear something on the radio about something and then go to the Wikipedia page and write it in himself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there are a lot of ways, you know, he'll hear about things from friends, or he'll go to a show and he'll learn some little tidbit that isn't on a band's Wikipedia page, and he'll go in there and add it himself. So he's not just making small mundane edits, but he's actually adding knowledge to these pages and these sites.
Yeah. Now, he has had you list some of the jobs that this guy has had in his life while still trying to maintain these edits that he does on Wikipedia. This guy's had a varied group of jobs, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. He's been a pizza delivery guy, a bookstore clerk, a computer lab assistant. He's had a lot of, you know, jobs that he says are of little importance. And for him, his job has really never been something to take over his life. He's always liked to take on smaller tasks and smaller jobs that leave him with more time to make edits.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of an interesting life he leads.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, what are the ones that, like, you do talk about this in the piece? What are the ones that are the most susceptible to trolls? Just people who go in and screw around on the page, and he has to keep back. And how often does he have to go back and change facts that he put in that have been changed? Does that have to happen? Does that happen often?
Yeah. So, you know, he'll occasionally make change. It usually happens on really highly controversial pages. He'll go in and make an edit, and someone will think it's not neutral enough, or they'll want to interject their own political opinion. So with pages like, you know, Barack Obama and George W. Bush, and even like the United States page, you'll see people going in and making changes that are politically biased because they want to interject their opinion.
Right.
And Wikipedia is really strict about that. They want to keep everything neutral. They don't want any opinions. They want just clear facts that are documented. But if you take a look at the list of the most controversial pages, and I base this on the number of revisions every year on average, George W. Bush's page gets about 45,000 revisions every year. United States gets 32,000. Jesus gets 26,000. Here's a really funny one. The second most edited page, right behind sandwich between George W. Bush and Jesus,
yeah,
is the list of WWE personnel. for some reason, people get really worked up about wrestling.
Yes, they do, Zach. That's
more than they do about Barack Obama in the United States. So,
that's the best thing ever. That is just the best.
Yeah, I mean, the WWE page has more edits combined than Adolf Hitler, Britney Spears, Michael Jackson, and Barack Obama combined. It's just unreal.
Oh, my God. All right, Zach, man, it's always a pleasure to have you, man. Congratulations on your job. Good luck on your move, man, and we'll get you back in a few weeks to talk more, because I really enjoy your writing, man. It's very entertaining and really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Nick. Thanks for having me, man.
Okay, buddy. Take care.
You too.
All right, there you go. Zach Crockett, everybody. I really love that guy. I do. He's so much fun to talk to, and his articles are so entertaining. So Zach Crockett, always a blast, and good luck to him moving over to Vox.com. All right, we're going to take a break here. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN.